The Off the Ball Podcast Network. Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Yeah, welcome along to Monday Night Rugby. Sadly, yet again, it's a case of quarterfinal and bust for Ireland at a Rugby World Cup. How did it all come to this? 46-14, the final score from Tokyo on Saturday morning, helping us to pick through the bones of that defeat and a lot more besides is former Leinster and Scotland coach Matty Williams, who joins us on the line. Matty, good evening to you.
Hey Richie, how you doing, mate?
I'd hope to speak to you in slightly more celebratory circumstances, let's be quite honest about it, but the reality of it was a 46-14 defeat, and I guess worth every point of that. I think the 14 probably flatters Ireland to a degree. I'll start with a couple of quotes, because this one has been regurgitated both from Rory O'Connor in the Indo today and from Gerry Thornley in the Times as well, saying back in May, David Nusafora, the RFU performance director, said, "I think we've got to do better than we've done before. That's the starting point, isn't it? We've got to get to a semi-final, and obviously we want to go further than that if we can, but I think we'd be kidding ourselves if we thought that anything worse than a semi-final is going to be good for us." And yet we arrive here where your most recent tweet on the match was, "I heard a pile of bullshit this week, a big performance holding secret players back, the Green Army, Ireland taking a step forward during the Haka. All utter bullshit. Today's performance is what you get when you don't have attacking and defensive systems that for all 2019 have been poor." And ultimately that's the reality of the match, isn't it? This goes back not to Saturday morning in Tokyo, but to February and the preparation to that first Six Nations game against England, because we were poor then, we were poor against Wales, we were poor in a couple of the warm-up games yet again, and Twickenham specifically. We're basically seeing the baby being born over in Tokyo.
Yeah, I'd even go back a little bit further than that, Richie. I'd go back and say it probably started the day Joe Schmidt announced he was leaving, which was just after the great win against New Zealand at the Aviva last November. And to me, that announcement was made with all the good intentions. Everything was done for the good of the future of Irish rugby. But that signalled to me the beginning of the end, because of the way Joe runs that team. And he, let's be really honest and fair here, Joe had run that team quite magnificently for a number of years, and Leinster magnificently for a number of years. But he's what they call the cultural architect. He's at the top of that pyramid, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's one way of running a team. But once he announced he was going, once that cultural architect says they're out, it has an impact on the group dynamics. And we've been seeing that impact for 12 months. None of it was done in malice. There's what's the good way out of this? I don't know. Probably to not say anything till post-World Cup. But that's not what they did. And therefore, the game, everything about the team stagnated. They didn't progress, they didn't grow, they didn't move forward. And more importantly, when the opposition, especially England, came up with a plan that really stifled Ireland, and we saw that in the first game at the Aviva this year, in the first game of the Six Nations, Ireland have really struggled to come up with play and tactics that gets past what the oppositions are doing to them. And they seem to get shrink closer and closer in their play. So their expansive play was almost non-existent. And because they didn't have an expansive play and their kicking game was pretty poor, teams were really easily keeping them in a very small box on the field. And they just became a really poor version of them former selves. They couldn't score tries, and more importantly, they couldn't stop the opposition scoring tries. I mean, it sounds so basic, and it was. That defeat was just going to happen for me. You know, I felt really, I was yelling at the TV, to be honest with you. I was sad and frustrated, but I was not surprised in any way. What surprised me most was that a lot of people were just not seeing this coming. And for me, that writing's been on the wall for a good 12 months.
Is that purely down to, like, it can't be surely as simple as Schmidt announcing he's leaving and the players mentally cycling out of what has been going on under Schmidt for the past 6 years or so?
It's a really interesting one, mate. Look, I had this conversation with Paul O'Connell. If you're going to drop a name, drop a big one. Paul O'Connell was going to, and Paul, you know, disagreed with me. He said, "Oh, what about Warren Gatland at Wales? Hasn't affected them." And I guess my point with this is there's a lot of studies done on team culture. And Gatland and Wales and Hansen and New Zealand have a different culture. They have a team culture. The Barcelona Football Club has, by the way, of being of an intergenerational club that no one is on top of the pile. Mm. It is a very flat structure. And so people can leave, as Hansen will at the end of this tournament, and I don't think you'll see much change in the New Zealand's performance. Gatland stepped in and out of that Wales team when he's taken the Lions because they have a different way of running it. So Alex Ferguson at Manchester United is the great example of that, where he announced he was retiring the end of the year. Manchester United's performances dipped in the February. He said, no, I'm not going to retire, I'm going to keep going. And their performances came back. And even he says he doesn't know why. And I don't think this is the only reason, but for me, as someone that studies group dynamics in teams, because I've stuffed it up myself in the past, like I know this is a really difficult area, and I've only got really interested in this really in the last 6 or 7 years, where I started to realise I didn't know a lot about this area, and I should have, because we're running teams that I was pointed out to me by there's a great book called The Barcelona Way, which goes into, I think it's Jim Affamore, I just can't quite remember now, one of the listeners might be able to throw that in to remind me, is the author, and it talks about this. Now, that was one of the aspects of the problems as I saw it. And again, people don't always agree with me on that. They're certainly not the only one, though, Richie. You know, to me, the biggest one that has dogged Ireland for a number of years was I said, there's going to come a day where you're going to need to score tries. And they just didn't have the attacking arrows in their quiver to fire when they needed to score tries. Joe's teams, when they're behind at halftime, really struggle to win. The stats on teams coached by Joe when they're behind at halftime, they usually lose. And when you're going into a World Cup, you're going to come a day when you're going to have to score tries, especially to beat New Zealand. They know they're going to have to play New Zealand or South Africa on their side of the pool for a long time. Yet we still persisted with a very one-off runners, abrasive style, plenty of good mauling. But we saw New Zealand absolutely nullify them all. Their defensive maul was absolutely spectacular. If there's any forwards coaches out there, go and watch how New Zealand defended Ireland's maul this week. It was absolutely textbook stuff. So when they stop that part of the game, what else have Ireland got to go to? And they haven't prepared themselves to have that other part of the game that's required to beat a team like New Zealand.
Does that surprise you that plateau was reached in 2018 and that there wasn't... I know Schmidt obviously announced then after that he was going to go after the All Blacks victory last autumn. Are you surprised that there wasn't, given the time, given the lead-in, given the importance that, as we mentioned, David Nusafora there and others probably had put on this World Cup, are you surprised that there wasn't an evolution of style, not even a drastic one? And I know he would have known he had a year left. Not even a drastic one, but enough of a one to get past this kind of systems that England put in place during the Six Nations, the kind of systems that, to a degree, Japan put in place during the pool phase, and definitely that we faced against the All Blacks on Saturday.
Yeah, I am. And it seems that, and I can't give you a reason why, you're only person or people who can do that are within the team, your coaching staff within the team. But there was no offloading. We don't use footwork before contact. Our forwards are running into defenders. And this has been happening for a few years. But we've been winning. So here you go. We win championships and we won a Grand Slam. And they are very admirable achievements. And we go down to Australia and we beat Australia in Australia. They are all very admirable achievements and they deserve great credit. And the team and Joe deserve great credit for that. But that style of rugby was never going to win at a World Cup. And this is your problem. We're not thinking in four-year cycles. Now, the New Zealanders, they have completely changed one, the personnel. Two, they've moved the best player in their team, Bowden Barrett, to fullback, in to give them more space in their attack. And they've come up with systems that allow them to, A, kick and chase, B, offload out of contact, and C, get the ball wide. Now, Ireland were not doing any of those. Now, why they weren't doing them, I don't know. Mm. I kept pointing them out in the Irish Times and on this show and other shows and getting 10 bells of abuse and saying I was jealous and of Joe and all this sort of stuff. When you're just saying, listen, I'm just observing what I'm seeing and saying, in my opinion, that's not going to cut the mustard at a World Cup. It's not going to beat New Zealand. And unfortunately, it's proved to be correct.
Just to note as well, our rugby coverage is with thanks to Vodafone, Team of Us, everyone in. You said there that, you know, Joe and maybe the setup weren't thinking in four-year cycles. The word from the camp always was that they were, especially given what transpired in Cardiff in 2015, that they were thinking in four-year cycles. They were thinking of the 2016 championship was played out with the notion of how we are going to build towards this World Cup in 2019. It just hasn't worked out. But I think the assertion that they weren't thinking in four-year cycles might be a little bit off.
Well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. If you can't beat Japan, they needed to score a couple of tries against Japan. They started well, then they got in a bit of a hole. That's okay. Japan have shown they're a very, very good side. And they were a real battle for South Africa for 60 minutes yesterday. And South Africa had to play some pretty direct rugby to get on top of them. But when we needed to score tries against Japan, we couldn't. Now, you've got to ask why. And I've listed off the skills that are missing from that team that they did not have. I would also question and say, well, why did we pick Robbie Henshaw at fullback in the first game of this year's Six Nations if we've been planning for 4 years that we needed another fullback? Why not do that on the summer tour down to Australia? Was winning that summer tour so important that we couldn't have left Sexton behind, maybe left Robbie Carney behind, and experiment with who could have played at fullback and at 10? Joey Carberry should have started every one of those games, and he didn't. There was more emphasis on beating Australia in a pretty grinding style than let's develop some players, give them some time down there and see how they go. For my part, I would have loved to have seen Joey Carberry play 15 on that tour, so that we look now and you can see Australia and New Zealand playing a playmaker at 15. Who gets the ball wide. Beauden Barrett at 15 is absolutely dynamic. Joey Carberry with a little bit more space around him could do the same thing. Now, we don't know because we didn't do it a long, long time before the World Cup. So there was talk that we were preparing and thinking in four-year cycles. But again, I wasn't seeing a lot of that coming out in selections. And more to the point, I saw some selections this year, as in 2019, that were very un-Joe Schmidt-like, and that proved to be, in my opinion, pretty poor selections.
Without wanting to get into a finger-pointing, what kind of selections are we talking about, Matt?
Well, Henshaw at fullback was a disaster. Hmm. You know, it was bad for Robbie. It also bad for the team. They started to doubt what was going on, and obviously it was a horrific result into that process. You know, I'm not so... I was very, very surprised that Devon Toner was left out. If Dev Toner was going to be left out, he should have been left out a while ago and other players given some more time in that position. I know there were a few injuries here and there, but that seemed just like a last second decision. We bring Klein in, we leave Dev out. And if you're going to still play a mauling game, so, you know, we left him out. Okay, then we're going to play a different game. We leave him out, we don't play it. Now, would he have made the side? Okay, there's arguments here and there. But again, it just shows to me that where's the thought going on in what sort of game we're going to be playing in that selection? I also think, you know, look, and I love the bloke. He was a captain of my Rory Best. You know, we probably, Rory was really coming to the end there. Robbie Carney, probably the same again. I feel really terrible talking about a guy that's been so loyal and so wonderful for the country and for his club. But we needed some alternatives in those positions. And it was very, very late in the day that we got those alternatives. Guys were not given a lot of time in those key positions. So that we had to, in the end, probably go with those guys when they weren't in great form.
it strikes me that Joe is kind of ruthless in the wrong way. Like you mentioned there, like dropping Toner just before the World Cup to bring in Jean Kleyn, where there are others that may have lived, like there's been good performances from the like the names that you mentioned here and there throughout the course of the last 12 months, but a lot of them would have got by on reputation that, as you alluded to in your tweet, that a big performance was due from, you know, X, Y and Z player that perhaps Joe just probably should have cut them off at the waist before they actually got the chance to play on Saturday.
Yeah, look, I think Joe went into that last game knowing that he needed a massive performance from the players, and he was going to take in the troops that had not let him down in the past. They'd been with him, and I get that as a coach. You get loyal to your players and you believe in them. But sometimes you can get too close to the players, you can be too loyal, and you can't see, you know, the forest for the trees. And I just think there were so many guys there that had not played a lot of rugby. You know, Robbie Henshaw hadn't played a lot of rugby. I know that their ham was the cast was done there because of the suspension to Bundiaki. Mm. I understand some of these things were forced upon them, but again, we had plenty of time through those summer tours and the November internationals to experiment with these things. And again, I think too much. The results are put way too heavily on the coaches. You know, are the coaches being incentivized to win those tournaments and those games? Because if the coaches are being incentivized to win that, they'll always put out the teams to win because they get paid more. That's just, I'd do the same thing. That's part of of what you're doing. But the incentivization should be coming in to getting a squad ready for the World Cup. Now, how do you incentivize that? How do you put that into a contract? It's very hard to say. But that Australian tour in particular just stood out for me as a lost opportunity. I said it at the time. Mm. And hindsight's perfect, but looking back, that was a very badly missed opportunity. Now, what it did lead to, let's keep the balance here, they beat New Zealand at the Aviva that next November. That's where I thought, well, okay, wow, maybe we have got a shot at this. But then the game did, there was not the progression in the game, there was not anything varying about our attack, even our defence. We got picked, we got sought out, and we didn't react from that. And there's been absolutely no reconstruction of the Irish play since that first game in 2009. And it's a very, very sad thing that we have to say that, but it's just the facts.
And it shows what a job Andy Farrell will have in his hands now in the next 6 months especially. I'm just curious, in your view, how much is Farrell tainted by what we've seen over the course of the last year?
Well, yeah, I certainly... Andy's got a really hard job, in my opinion, because the obvious appointment of Andy was to say we want the work, the legacy of Joe to continue. That's the obvious statement of making an assistant coach the now head coach. And look, that's just really clear. There's got to be a big reset of the way Ireland attack and the way they defend, because they defended really badly against New Zealand. Let's again not... Cut to the chase here. The defence was appalling. We had set play tries scored against us. The Blacks took that defence off the scrums apart. Our back row defence, in particular, off the scrums, was non-existent. Artie Sevilla went into number eight on a couple of scrums and ran straight past CJ Stander and Josh Vandefleur. CJ was still on the scrum when the tackle was being made by Johnny Sexton. I mean, it was really, really bad defence off those scrums. And they're scoring tries off set play. You should never score tries off set play. Now, Ireland did it to New Zealand at the Aviva, and that was quite embarrassing. They did it to us there the other day, and it was bad. Now, Andy's never been a head coach. So he's going to have to come into a role that he's never done. He's going to have to look at our attack and defence and come up with some really new plays. Now, I'd also say that I disagree with some of the talk going around the traps. I don't see a lot of footwork and a lot of offloading from our teams at club level in our provinces. And I think there's going to have to be – Leinster do it a bit, to be fair, and that's part of the Leinster tradition. But not a lot. They're still doing a highly structured game, which is what Joe did, and Leo's carried that on, and Leo's done an exceptionally good job there. But they're going to have to introduce some skills into the provinces with especially in our forwards, of footwork and offloading, and a much more lateral game to get through defences before we go around them, before that national teams come forward. Now, there's no time for that. They've got a couple of Heineken Cups, and they've got the local games, and then before you know it, the Six Nations is going to be on us. And it's a very sad thing to say, a very difficult thing to say, but I think the pressure is going to be right on Andy from day one. That's the gig now, because it has been a failure, this World Cup, and everyone's going to be looking to get this team going forward. They've got France away and they've got England away, and that is also going to be hard, because I think you're going to find France away in particular are going to be a much, much improved side under Fabien Galthié than they have been in recent years with the mix of coaching they've had over there. So, yeah, it's going to be a tough one.
Just a final note, because I know you would have been keeping an eye on things, French, over the course of the weekend as well. They ever so slightly shot themselves in the foot. That was a game that was there for the winning against Wales, against, you know, handy enough Wales side. Could have been the proper rebirth of French rugby over in Japan, and completely blew it with that sending off.
Completely and utterly blew it. But if you think back to the Six Nations, they did the same thing. They had Wales on the ropes, and it was Vahamuna, the same thing, threw a big intercept try late in the pass, and I think it was North took the intercept late in the game in the Six Nations, and they just lost that game. Like, you just watched it and you couldn't believe what you were seeing. It just unraveled before your eyes. They had Wales beaten for all money. And that was one of the most ridiculous send-offs. It is the most ridiculous send-offs I've ever seen at a World Cup, because I can't recall too many send-offs at a World Cup until this World Cup. Now, most of those have been for
high challenges,
high challenge, a couple of bad tackles. But to elbow a guy in the face when your team's leading, you're up there, and just a lack of discipline, it's mind-boggling. People here are saying it's like Zinedine Zidane's headbutt at the Football World Cup a couple of years ago. You just shake your head at it. And that poor, you know, I'll be really honest, that poor guy, he is, in France as I speak to you, he is copping it on every piece of media, social media. He's on national television. He's in the newspapers, in L'Équipe. He is just copping it, the poor man. And it was truly one of the most ridiculous acts I've ever seen in rugby.
Yeah, a lot of work for Galthié to do, I suppose, in the new year too. Matty, we'll let you go. Thanks so much for taking time to speak to us this evening.
Pleasure, mate. Great to talk to you.
Cheers. Take care.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.